You probably noticed that Isaiah 7, which contains Isaiah 7:14, which is the Messianic prophecy, is not the easiest of all passages. So what we're going to do is a very brief review to bring us up to where we were last time. And as we go through the review, if anybody has a question, feel free to ask. Some of this you should recollect. Now, the context, the historical context here is we have, and I'm going to make a little drawing on the board for just a moment. This will help. Here we have, for lack of, that's Israel. You didn't know I was an artist, did you? Well, I don't know what to say. Actually, it looks more like a tooth. But here's Israel. Now, we know the kingdom became divided. So here's Judah. This is not to scale, obviously. And here's Israel. That's a smaller... It's probably bigger than I made it here. This is not to scale. But this is Aram, another country or, you know, territory. And then all out in here is Assyria to the north. And what we saw was that, here's the situation. Assyria is becoming very powerful. They're becoming an empire. And they're gobbling up small countries. So Aram and Israel form a so they won't be gobbled up. But they're not powerful enough. They can't do it. So they approach King Ahaz in Judah and say to him, enter the alliance with us, then it'll be three against them. We'll stand a better chance. However, Ahaz had an alliance with Assyria. He was under their protection as far as he was concerned. He was paying large amounts of tribute to Assyria. So he refused the offer of an alliance between Israel with Israel and Aram. He'd rather rely on Assyria. So Israel and Aram get together and they say, well, let's attack Judah. Oppose Ahaz, get rid of him. Put our own king on the throne. You didn't know I was an artist, did you? That's a king. Wait.
He's a bad king.
There's a scepter. His scepter. Okay. Now, and so they're going to attack Judah. Now, there's two issues in the prophecies that we're studying here. One issue is the Davidic covenant, because Ahaz is in the kingly line. So if Israel and Aram are successful and they get rid of Ahaz and put their own king on the throne, that's the end of the Davidic covenant, which, of course, God can't allow that to happen. Another aspect of the chapter, of prophecy in the chapter, is judgment against Judah. And we're going to see that too. Judah is to be judged. Ahaz was extremely wicked, and as was all of Judah, and so there's going to be judgment coming on Judah, okay? So that's the historical background we went over last time. Now, to continue with background material, when Aram and Israel allied with one another to go against Judah, of course, Ahaz and Judah became very scared, two against one. And so God sent the prophet Isaiah, who lived at this time and was a prophet of Judah, to Ahaz. If you remember, at the time, Ahaz was inspecting one of the conduits, one of the aqueducts, to make sure there'd be enough water in case they got attacked. And God said to him, go and talk to Ahaz and bring your son with you, Shir Yashab. That's very significant to this prophecy, very significant. So Ahaz goes to, Isaiah goes to Ahaz, and he has this conversation with Ahaz. Now, there's a series of signs in here, prophecies. And you know how a miracle can just be a miracle, but it can also be a sign? In other words, it can be something to communicate information. For example, when Yeshua raised Lazarus from the dead, it was a miracle. It was also what we call a sign, because what it did was it pointed to him verifying he was the Messiah. These signs that are being given to either Ahaz or to the house of Judah or to all of Judah are all predictive prophecies. And they all relate either to this situation about Israel and Aram attempting to overthrow the kingly line of David, or, as we'll see, one of them at least relates to judgment that's to fall upon Judah for their ungodliness. Because that's all like background material. Are you with me so far? Okay, so now, Isaiah and his son meet Ahaz. And basically speaking, the first message that Ahaz receives from Isaiah is in Isaiah 7, 4 to 7. 4 to 7. This is the first message he gives him. Ready? Now watch. Take care and be calm. Have no fear and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands. And that's figure of speech. The two smoldering stubs of firebrand are the king of Aram and the king of Israel. On account of the fierce anger of, and here's how we know, Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has planned evil against you, saying, and here's their plan, let us go up against Judah and terrorize it and make for ourselves a breach in its walls and set up a son of Tabeel as a king in the midst of it. They wanted to put up a puppet son who would cooperate with their plan to have this three-nation alliance against Assyria. And then in verse 7 is the first prophecy. It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. So in a sense, God is giving comfort to Ahaz and to Judah, saying to them, they will not overthrow you as king, and they will not conquer Judah. And then he says, for the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. And then here's a prophecy. Now within another 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered so that it is no longer a people. Now there Ephraim is Israel. It's not unusual in the Bible for Israel to be referred to as Ephraim, because Ephraim, one of the 12 tribes, had a piece of land in Israel that was given to them when the land was divided up. It was pretty big. And they used to sometimes refer to Israel as Ephraim. Okay? So that did come to pass, as we saw last time. We're not going to go into the minutia detail of how it came to pass, but within 65 years, Israel was no longer a people. They became the 10 lost tribes. The Assyrians took them away. The Assyrians did conquer them and took them into captivity, and then they got lost. So that came to pass. Okay? So obviously, the threat to Ahaz and to Judah is alleviated by that. But notice, it didn't happen for 65 years. So how's Ahaz to know that it won't happen for another 65 years? Well, there's a short term. Well, let's just continue on. Okay, now, the Lord does something very gracious to Ahaz in verse 10. Then the Lord spoke to Ahaz again, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God, make it as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. And so God is offering Ahaz, ask me for a sign, a miracle, and I'll do it, and that'll confirm that the prophecy is true. Okay? Everybody with me so far? We haven't gotten to the notes yet, but now turn to 150. Turn to 150. Because I want to clarify something. Remember I said how can he be certain that in 65 years Israel will no longer be a people? He won't even be alive. Well, first way he can know, go to page 150 and go down to D. Isaiah told King Ahaz that the reason the Davidic dynasty would not succeed was that both Israel and Aram were headed by mere men, like two stubs of smoldering firebrands. That's a figurative language for just two mere men. Their lives would soon end and the threat would be gone. Mere men cannot thwart the plans of God. Now that's a short-term prophecy, isn't it, right? Ironically and possibly, well, we don't have to read that. That's not important. Go to the next page and watch what happens. Rezin was soon killed in a battle with the Assyrians and was Aram's last king. So that's the end of Aram. They're no longer a threat. Pekah lost half his kingdom in the ensuing battles, became an Assyrian vassal, and was killed by Hoshea, the son of Ela, 1 year later. He was the next to the last king of Israel. The word of the Lord through Isaiah was fulfilled as predicted. So now Ahaz has this short-term prophecy that will be fulfilled in his lifetime, which he can say to himself, well, Isaiah was right here. He'll be right here. It's like the weatherman. If you watch your weatherman every night and he's always right, if he says expect rain tomorrow, you're smart to take your umbrella. Because he's been right in all of his, let's call them predictions, his forecasts. Well, if Isaiah was right, and he was, about what happened to Pekah and Rezin, it stands to reason that he's a prophet of God and he'll be right that in 65 years Israel will no longer be a people. Everybody got that? Okay, now. The fact of the matter is that the prophecy, and this is covered on page 151, but we're not going to read through it. We read through it last time. I'll summarize. Within 65 years to the year, Israel was no longer a people. The deportation into Assyria, two waves, and it was fulfilled within 65 years. Okay, everybody with me so far? Now you can see what's happened here. Isaiah is really giving him a series of prophecies here that are significant. And you can see that so far these prophecies relate to what we're talking about, the Davidic covenant, right? That it's secure. Okay, so now as we said, page 152, God offers a sign to Ahaz and Ahaz rejects it. And as we said last time, Ahaz puts on this kind of cloak of spirituality. I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord, blah, blah, blah. But he's not really a spiritual man. There's two reasons he didn't want a sign. Number one, if he asked for a sign and got it, he would pretty much be compelled by the people of Judah to break his alliance with Assyria and trust in the Lord his God, which he did not want to do. Secondly, it would confirm Isaiah as a prophet of God, and Isaiah had been prophesying doom on Judah if they didn't repent, and he didn't want Isaiah to be lifted up in the eyes of the people. But God's response was he was going to give him a sign anyway, and he gives him more than one. Okay, now, go to page 154. This will be the next significant thing we have to look at. So everybody knows where we are so far.
We have this dialogue here. I don't want to sign. And then here's the... And okay, now. In verse 13, Isaiah stopped addressing Ahaz as an individual and addressed the entire house of Judah. Remember we talked about how the word you there can be plural or singular in the Hebrew? So in verse 13, when it says, "Listen now, O house of David." See, at first, in verse 11... Well, see in verse 10, it says, "Then the Lord spoke again to Ahaz." So the Lord's just speaking to Ahaz. But in verse 13, he's speaking to the entire house of David. Everybody got it? Now, I should show you, let me put this on the board, just so we got it straight. This is how it works. This is Judah. That's all the people of Judah. Within the people of Judah is what we could call the house of David. Those are all of the men who are in the kingly line, right? They're all Judites, right? They're all from the tribe of Judah, and they're all live in Judah. This has a number of branches. David had more than one son, and they had sons, and they had sons. One of the branches in here is the house of Ahaz. He's in here, and his descendants are in here, aren't they? He's in the kingly line. Everybody got it so far? So I just want to differentiate. When we talk about Judah, the house of David, or Ahaz himself. Or if God says to Ahaz, your house, he's talking about Ahaz's descendants, not necessarily all of David's descendants. Everybody see that? Okay. Now, continuing on. Good morning. Continuing on. So now God's giving a sign. In verse 13, he says, he starts addressing the entire house of David, not just Ahaz. And he's going to give a sign to the house of David. And it's in verse 14. "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she shall call his name Emmanuel." Okay? Now, this prophecy is a distant prophecy. And basically speaking, what God is saying to the house of David is the kingly line of David will stand until the Messiah comes, Emmanuel, who will be born of a virgin. Okay? That's a sign to the house of David. Now again, how can the house of David know that this will come to pass? Because Isaiah's short-term prophecies came to pass. He's confirmed as a prophet of God. Okay? Okay. Now, go to Roman numeral 18. In verse 14, the Hebrew word translated behold, where it says behold, the Lord himself... No, it says the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive. The word behold is in the present participle, indicating that it refers to a future event. That's how we know it's a distant prophecy. Okay, the language tells us. That is the case here. The prophecy of the virgin birth is a prophecy that from the perspective of the house of David in Isaiah's time would take place in the distant future. And it did. It took place in the distant future from their perspective. Okay, now, Emmanuel translates into the English, God is with us. Thus the child born of the virgin would be the God-man anticipated by Eve in Genesis 4:1. Remember Genesis 4:1 where Eve says, behold, I have gotten a man, the Lord? Okay, so this distant descendant would be God incarnate, the seed of David. And it's basically, as we see in B, a promise to the by God to the house of David that it cannot lose this identity until the virgin conceives and gives birth.
obviously, what the basically one of the things that God is saying to the house of David is, don't be afraid of Aram and Israel. They're not going to overthrow Ahaz as king and conquer Judah. Everybody follow the reasoning there? Okay. Now, again, we mentioned it before. One of the things that this tells us is the Messiah has to have come before 70 CE. Because in 70 CE, the Romans destroyed the temple and all the records. And so after 70 CE, nobody could come and claim to be the Messiah because they couldn't verify their lineage back to David. Okay, now, go to where it says the signs to King Ahaz, verses 15 to 25. This is where we're going to kind of begin, not really new stuff, but almost new. Isaiah presents his prophecies to Ahaz and the house of David in an interesting way, reverse chronological order. Now let's go to verse 15. Now here's the first thing I want to do because this was a question from last time. Watch. Therefore the Lord, verse 14. Therefore the Lord will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. Okay, we've already looked at that. Distant prophecy. Assurance to the house of David. Right? Now watch. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. The thing we talked about last time is who is he? Does it refer back to verse 14 to the child, the virgin, the child born of the virgin, or forward to verse 15? Now, let me give you reasons why it points forward to 15. First of all, you'll notice that in verse 15, the word he, the second time it's used in many, in some translations, is, has capital H, right? That means the translators interpreted this, not translated it, but interpreted that the he in verse 15 is the child in verse 14, Emmanuel. Everybody understand that? That he's God. That's interpretive. It's not translational because there was no upper and lower case in the Hebrew. That's all uppercase. That's the Hebrew alphabet. It's all uppercase. Now, they do now in modern times have lowercase, but they didn't back then. Now, here's why it refers forward. A number of reasons. First of all, as I said last time, you see it says he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For, you see how that word for, it connects verses 15 and 16. The boy. Who is the boy? The boy is Isaiah's child, his son. This is going to give us the reason Isaiah was told to bring his son. Also, notice something about verses 15 and 16. They both mention something significant about the boy that's very similar. You see where it says in verse 15, at the time he knows to refuse evil and choose good? Notice in verse 16 it says, before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good. Same person. Saying the same thing about the same person, but just slightly differently. Also, as we will see as we go through this, you see where it says he will eat curds and honey? Later on in the prophecy, we're going to see that this he would eat curds and honey, this he, in the short term, not the long term. He's going to eat curds and honey shortly after the prophecy is given when Judah is judged, not in the distant future when the virgin birth takes place. Everybody follow that? And we'll see that in a few minutes. But does everyone understand what I'm saying? I don't see heads nodding. Don't make me nervous. Okay, let's continue. Okay. So we did the prophecy of the virgin birth. Now go down to 19b.
No, go to A first. He first records the most distant. He did these things, these prophecies in 14, 15, and 16, they're in reverse chronological order. Watch, A. He first records the most distant prophecy in verse 14, the prediction of the virgin birth. Then in verse 15, Isaiah records a short-term prophecy directed to Ahaz and his house that will be fulfilled. Now notice this. At the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. As we shall see shortly, he is Isaiah's son. And I have some stuff in the notes to back up what I've said just now. This prophecy is explained and expanded on in verses 17 to 25. What does it mean he will eat curds and honey? Well, we'll see. Okay, go on to C now. In verse 16, Isaiah records another prophecy directed to Ahaz and his house that will be fulfilled even before the short-term prophecy in verse 15 is fulfilled. Now watch the difference in the wording between verses 15 and 16. In verse 16, it says, before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, right? Note, before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, in verse 16, chronologically precedes at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good, in verse 15. Do you see that? In verse 15, he's matured. In verse 16, he's not yet reached the age of what we would call moral maturity. In verse 16, in verse 15, he has. Everybody see that? It's kind of reverse chronological order, but you can see, and it's not important to know how old was he. It's not the absolute ages that are important here, it's the relative ages. Okay? All right, now continue with me. We have already discussed the distant prophecy in verse 14 concerning the virgin birth, the sign of the house of David. Now watch what I do. For the sake of clarity, we will discuss the remaining two prophecies, the one in 15 and the one in 16, in chronological order. That is in the order that they are fulfilled. It's just a little easier to understand to do it. So we're going to actually take verse 16 first, before he's able to know good and refuse evil. The first of these two short-term prophecies to be fulfilled is found in verse 16. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. Who are the two kings? Rezin and Pekah, right? The you in verse 16 is again singular, meaning that God is once again speaking to King Ahaz. In verse 16, God gives King Ahaz a sign that will assure him that the threat imposed on his dynasty by Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, king of Israel, will not succeed. Now read with me. The boy in verse 16 is the boy mentioned in the context of the passage, Isaiah's young son. The prophecy states that before the boy grows to sufficient maturity to know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose kings you dread will be forsaken. In other words, before Isaiah's son reached moral maturity, the alliance between Rezin and Pekah would be broken. Everybody understand that? Okay. The reason Isaiah was told to take his son along with him when he spoke to King Ahaz now becomes clear. The boy was used as an object lesson for King Ahaz. Remember, this is the only time in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that God had a prophet go to speak to a king and bring his child with him. KC, the prophecy that the two-king alliance against the house of David would fall was fulfilled in King Ahaz's time. For within 3 years, the kings of Israel and Aram were deposed, and the threat they imposed upon the house of Ahaz ended. Okay, got that so far? Everybody with me? All right, now let's go on to the next short-term prophecy, which is going to be in verse 15. The next short-term prophecy to be fulfilled is found in verse 15 and explained in verses 17 to 25. So first we'll look at the prophecy, then we're going to look at verses 17 to 25 just because it's going to expand and explain it. Now here's the prophecy. He, the boy, will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. So this is sometime after the prophecy in verse 16, right? Got it? We must first confirm to whom the pronoun he in verse 15 refers. This is what I was mentioning before, but let's look at it in the notes. Does it refer back to the son, Messiah, in verse 14, or forward to the boy, Isaiah's son, in verse 16? Now, I have two reasons. There's actually three, but let's look at the two first. There are two reasons that we should conclude that the pronoun he in verse 15 is the boy in verse 16. Verse 16 begins with the word for. For is what we call an explanatory. An explanatory connects that which precedes it with that which follows it. Specifically, that which follows the word for explains that which precedes the word for. That's how we use the word for. It's similar to the word because. I am going downtown today for I must go to court, or because I must go to court. You see how those phrases are connected together by the explanatory. Okay? Two, also in both verses 15 and 16, the subject of the sentence, he in verse 15 and boy in verse 16, is described as knowing enough to refuse evil and choose good. That precisely the same thing is said about the subject of each sentence lends additional weight to the conclusion that they are one and the same person, Isaiah's son. In other words, the he is the boy, not the child in verse 14. See it? All right, now continue. Is everybody with me? This is not the easiest stuff in the world. I know that. Big pop quiz at the end of this. All right, ready? Let's go. The prophecy states he, Isaiah's son, will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. The key to understand the meaning of this prophecy is found in verses 17 to 25. Now let's read verses 17 to 25 and see what they say. The Lord will bring on you, who is you? That's Ahaz, right? Speaking to Ahaz again. And your people, that's the house of Ahaz and Judah. No, that's the house, that's Judah. And on your father's house, that's the house of Ahaz. So all of Judah, the king, the house of Ahaz and Judah. Such days as have never come since the day that Ephraim separated from Judah when they became a divided kingdom, the king of Assyria. Now, read with me. In that day, the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest part of the rivers of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. They will all come and settle on the steep ravines, on the ledges of the cliffs, and on the thorn bushes and all the watering places. In that day, the Lord will shave with a razor hired from regions beyond the Euphrates, that is, with the king of Assyria, the heads and the hair of the legs, and it will also remove the beard. It's a time of judgment, clearly. And Assyria is going to be the sword in God's hand that will be used to judge Judah, right? Now read this with me. This is significant. Now in that day a man may keep alive a heifer and a pair of sheep, and because of the abundance of milk produced, he will eat curds. Notice that is parallel to that boy eating curds, right? He will eat curds, for everyone that is left within the land will eat curds and honey. Now, what does that mean when it says everyone left in the land will eat curds and honey? Read with me in the notes. Number one on the bottom of page 157. Verses 17 to 25 indicate that Isaiah's son would be raised in a time of national calamity. We can see that. God would judge King Ahaz's house and the inhabitants of Judah for forsaking him by trusting in the might of, and that should not be Judah, that should be Assyria. That's a typo. Instead of the Lord their God. Okay, got it? These would be the worst enemy attacks since the 10 northern tribes, here called Ephraim, broke from the two southern tribes in 931 BCE. It's going to be a very bad time. From Ahaz's day on, Judah was troubled by the Assyrian Empire, the very empire to which it paid tribute and in which it trusted, forsaking the Lord their God. In verse 15, Isaiah's son is described as eating curds and honey. Verse 22, part of the passage describing the distress that would come upon Judah, expands on this, stating that everyone that is left within the land will eat curds and honey. You see it? More evidence that he is the boy who will eat curds and honey. But not only him, that's what their diet's going to consist of in Judah. Now continue to read with me. This is important. A, the abundance of milk, curds comes from milk, right, was a distressful thing, not a good thing, with many animals dying. A farmer's young heifer and two sheep would have no young to nurse, so the milk they produced and the curds from it would be plentiful for the people. That would be what made up a large portion of their diet. Everybody follow? All the animals are dying off. And so the few animals that they have, when they're lactating, they don't have any young to suckle. And so they have the people drink the milk. Now, continue to read. Honey would also be plentiful because wildflowers would grow in the desolate fields where there used to be wheat and so forth, attracting swarms of bees that would pollinate them and produce an abundance of honey. So the eating of curds and honey is an indication of judgment. It's different from when God says, I'm going to bring you into land flowing with milk and honey. It's a different usage of those symbols. That's the importance of interpreting in context. This prophecy was dramatically fulfilled. I got ahead of myself. Number three. Based on the foregoing discussion, we may conclude that verse 15 and verses 17 to 25 predict a distressful time for Judah and for the house of Ahaz. The Assyrian army would attack Judah and the land would be devastated. This prophecy was dramatically fulfilled. Assyrian invasions devastated the land in the time of Ahaz's successor, Hezekiah. So it was fulfilled. Conclusion. Isaiah 7 contains four separate prophecies, each having its own fulfillment. A. The prophecy that within 65 years Ephraim would be shattered so that it is no longer a people. Verse 8. B. Three additional prophecies that form a multiple reference. They come one right on top of the other. 1. A distant prophecy given to the house of David, predicting the virgin birth of Messiah, son of David, and giving the house of David assurance that the promises contained in the Davidic covenant would be fulfilled. That's verse 14. 2. A short-term prophecy given to Ahaz that the plot of the kings of Aram and Israel to overthrow the Davidic dynasty would fail. Additional assurance that the Davidic covenant would be fulfilled. 3. A short-term prophecy given to King Ahaz that God would judge Ahaz's people and his father's house for forsaking him and trusting in the might of Assyria. God would use the Assyrian army to judge them. His army would attack and devastate the land of Judah. That's verse 15 and also expanded on in verses 17 to 25. All of these prophecies are significant. However, the prophecy concerning the virgin birth is especially significant for two reasons. A, as we shall see, it is one of the most controversial messianic prophecies in the Tanakh, and we'll get to that. B, Its fulfillment is an extremely important aspect of God's plan of redemption. It is through the miracle of the virgin birth that God the Son became incarnate, the sinless Son of Messiah, who alone was qualified to give his life for the sins of the world. Okay. Now, those are the prophecies, and we're going to stop there. Now, here's where the controversy lies. Go to verse 160. As we mentioned earlier, now this is an addendum to what we just read. This is like an afterword. As we mentioned earlier, the prophecy of the virgin birth is one of the most controversial prophecies in the Tanakh. The controversy focuses on the correct translation of the Hebrew word Alma in 7:14. You see where it says, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive"? The question is, the word that's translated virgin there is the Hebrew word Alma. And that's the controversy. Is it correctly translated Alma? Now read A with me. Bibles published by publishing houses operated by believers like the New American Standard, the NIV, the New King James, translate the Hebrew word Alma in Isaiah 7:14, virgin. Born-again scholars also believe that the word Alma in Isaiah 7:14 should be translated virgin. However, Bibles published by non-believing Jewish publishing houses, for example, the Jewish Publication Society, go to a synagogue and ask the rabbi to show you a Bible. He'll show you a Bible. It only has the Old Testament, and it's probably published by the Jewish Publication Society. That's a big publishing, Jewish publishing house. Okay? They translate the word Alma in Isaiah 7:14, young woman or maiden, not virgin. Furthermore, modern-day rabbis and some liberal theologians teach that the word Alma in Isaiah should be translated young woman and not virgin. Now, this is very important. Continue to read with me. Determining the correct meaning of the Hebrew word Alma is extremely important. In his gospel, Matthew recorded as a literal historical event the miracle of the virgin birth and claimed that it fulfilled Isaiah's prophecy of the virgin birth in Isaiah... Isaiah 7:14. Now, as we read through this, I don't know how this happened in my brain. Every time you see the word Luke, it should be Matthew. I don't know what happened. I must have had a short period of dementia. So I'm going to say Matthew when I see the word Luke. Okay, so he claimed that it fulfilled Isaiah's prophecy of the virgin birth of Isaiah 7:14, and that's recorded in Matthew 1:19-23. He records the virgin birth and says, this was to fulfill what was prophesied by the prophet Isaiah, a virgin shall conceive. Matthew's wording is clear in the Greek language in which he wrote. When translating Isaiah 7:14, Matthew translated the Hebrew word Alma into the Greek word parthenos, which can only refer to a virgin. There's no ambiguity in the Greek word parthenos. Okay? So we want to see, did Matthew translate correctly? One. Now here's why it's so important. If Matthew is wrong and Alma does not refer to a virgin, then the Brit Chadashah contains an error. Right? This would mean that the Brit Chadashah is neither inerrant, inspired by God, nor authoritative. The plan of redemption set forth in the Brit Chadashah would be invalid, Yeshua's messiahship would be baseless, and believers in Yeshua would still be in their sins. That's why that song about one word is important. Two, conversely, if Matthew was right, and the Hebrew word Alma does refer to a virgin, then the integrity of the Brit Chadashah, that's the New Testament, remains intact. It is the inspired, inerrant, authoritative word of God. Its assertion that Yeshua is the Messiah is valid, and believers in Yeshua are saved from the penalty of their sins. So you can see how important an issue this is, this single word. Okay, now, three. Because of the importance of this issue, we will study the Hebrew word Alma from a number of perspectives that we may confidently determine Isaiah's intended meaning of the word when he wrote it in Isaiah 7:14. We will begin our study by looking at all of the uses of the word Amma in the Tanakh. We're going to look at every single one. And determining what various authors of the Tanakh and God intended the word Amma to mean. We're now going to look at every single time in the Old Testament the Hebrew word Amma is used. And see if we can see what the authors meant when they used it. Because it's pretty easy. Watch. If these authors all intended that Amma have the same meaning, we may reasonably conclude that the meaning of Amma intended by these authors was the meaning of Amma to the original readers, the ancient Jewish people. This being the case, we could further conclude that Isaiah intended the word Amma to have the same meaning as it did to the other prophets who used it. The meaning of Amma to his original readers, who were also the ancient Jewish people. This is an application of the hermeneutical principle God intended that the scriptures be understood by those to whom it was written. So this is pure hermeneutics. Now let's look at these verses. Genesis 24:43. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and may it be that the maiden, and the Hebrew is Amma there, who comes out to draw water. This is when Abraham sent his servant to get a wife for Isaac, remember, and his servant prayed. And this is the prayer. Please let me drink a little water from your jar. In this passage, Abraham's servant is seeking a wife for Isaac. The word Amma is used to describe Rebekah, who was clearly a virgin when she married Isaac, for Genesis 24:6 says of her, and the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had relations with her, and she went down to the spring and filled a jar and came up. So clearly, the first time in the Bible that the word Am is used, it clearly means virgin, right? 2, Exodus 2:8. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, now this is when Moses' older sister put him on the water and Pharaoh's daughter found them. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden, Ha'ama, that's the Hebrew, went and called the child's mother. In this passage, Amma refers to Moses' young sister Miriam, who clearly was a virgin. She was just a child.
Twenty-four six was what?
Were you wearing? Genesis 24:6. All right, let me get the right one then. Give me a second. I'll get you the right one. Genesis, what happened here? Okay, now the first one. Yeah, it should be 16. Can I borrow your pen for a minute? I got to correct this so that I got it right in my thing. 24:16. Thank you. Okay. So thank you for pointing that out. Okay, let's move on now. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go, so the maiden Amma. We did that already. Next, Psalm 68:25. The singers went on, the musicians after them, in the midst of the maidens, Amma, beating tambourines. In this passage, the maidens are part of the royal procession who sang, danced, and played tambourines before God the King. Amma is the only word in the biblical Hebrew language that unequivocally signifies an unmarried woman. So that we can say about it, that there's no doubt about. Thus, children born to an Amma would be illegitimate, right? If she's unmarried. Because the king in this context is God, it's required that the maidens be virgin, for God would not allow an immoral unmarried woman in his procession. Therefore, the word Amma in Psalm 68:25 must refer to a virgin. What's the matter?
I don't think that quite cuts it because theoretically God would allow a
harlot.
Not yet had a child.
No, but you got to understand something. What we're saying here is the word Amma always means an unmarried woman. That we know.
Wait.
One step at a time. The word Amma does always mean an unmarried woman. Therefore, if an Amma is not a virgin, she has committed adultery. And this is a procession, a holy procession before God the King.
So you're saying no childless.
No, forget whether she has a child or not. All I'm saying is, forget children. It doesn't matter whether she's had a child. What matters is, has she had sexual relationships before marriage? Because if she has, she's immoral. And she's disqualified from being in God's holy procession. Whether she's had a child from that physical relationship or not. God's not going to allow an immoral woman who has committed adultery to be in his holy procession. Okay, next, Song of Solomon. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, may he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore, the maidens, Amma, love you. One of the important themes in the Song of Solomon is purity in marriage. Very important theme. Because the word Amma refers to an unmarried woman, as we've established in three above, it is reasonable to conclude that the maidens who loved the bridegroom were pure, that is, virgins. It's a similar argument to the one above. Solomon would not allow an immoral woman in the procession in the Song of Solomon because the theme is purity. Now, here's an interesting one. Song of Solomon 6:8. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens, Amma, without number. In this verse, the word Amma is contrasted with queens and concubines who would be non-virgins. Therefore, the Amma here are virgins. That's the contrast that's being set up. And one more, I think, yeah. Proverbs 30:18-20. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, then the way of a man with a maiden, Amma. This is the way of an adulteress. Now here's a contrast being set up between the Amma and the adulteress. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I have done no wrong. The way of a woman with a maiden, Amma, refers to a man's affectionate courtship of an unmarried woman. Remember, Amma always refers to an unmarried woman. Whereas verse 19 describes the way of a man with a maiden, verse 20 describes an immoral woman's way with men. Thus, an adulteress in verse 20 is contrasted with Amma in verse 19. This contrast, consistently applied to the passage, indicates that whereas the adulteress in verse 20 is not a virgin, the Amma in verse 19 is a virgin. Everybody with me? Okay, Isaiah 7:14. Now we're at the final passage. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. As we can see from the above study of all of these verses in the Tanakh that contain the Hebrew word Amma, the authors of the Tanakh consistently intended that the word Amma refer to a virgin. Using the hermeneutical principle that Scripture interprets Scripture and based on the reasonable conclusion that in the ancient Israel of the prophets, the word Amma was understood to mean virgin, we may conclude that God, who inspired the Scriptures and intended that we understand them, intended that the Hebrew word Amma in Isaiah 7:14 refers to a virgin. All right, now, let's continue. Another argument. There are two other words Isaiah could have used to describe the woman in Hosea 7:14. One is the Hebrew word Betula, and the other is Na'ara. Some Hebrew rabbis assert that one of those words, Betula, can only mean virgin, and that if Isaiah intended to emphatically assert that the younger woman in Isaiah 7:14 would be a virgin, he would have chosen that word. We shall now evaluate the rabbi's argument. The rabbis assert that had Isaiah been referring to a virgin in Isaiah 7:14, he would have used the word Betula and not the word Alma. However, as the following passages illustrate, Betula can refer either to a virgin or a non-virgin. Now watch, Genesis 24:16. And the damsel was very fair to look upon, a virgin, Betula, neither had any man known her, and she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. In Genesis 24:6, because the word Betula should be in there, because the word Betula does not exclusively mean virgin, Moses adds the phrase, neither had any man known her, in order to clarify that he's referring to a virgin. In other words, if Betula could only mean virgin, Moses would not have had to waste words saying, neither had any man known her. See that? He has to clarify. Judges 21:12. They found among the people living in Jabesh Gilead 400 young women, Betula, who had never slept with a man. Notice that qualification there. And they took them to the camp at Shiloh in Canaan. In Judges 21:12, the author also clarifies that he is referring to a virgin by adding the words who had never slept with a man. Based on the above passages of Scripture, the word Betula can refer either, it should be to a virgin or a non-virgin. The rabbi's assertion that Isaiah would have used Betula if, I don't know why the word if is here twice, if he would, oh, no, it, if has a capital F, it shouldn't. If he was referring to a virgin in Isaiah 7:14 is not valid. Betula can mean either one. Yes.
On page at the top on 164, you have the Genesis 24:16. And are you giving an example or are you giving a quote? Because you say that Betula is used there for virgins, but 24:16 back on 161, you say Alma was used. Or 24:16.
I got to check the verse. Let me see 24:16. Let me see something. Something's not right here. Oh, I got to go back to Genesis now, don't I? Genesis. Yeah, let me see. Genesis 24. 16. Let me see something. Version, give me just a second. Where's the first time I put it? Where's the Isaiah passage? Where's that? Genesis. Genesis
8:161.
Email. I got to check that. Something's wrong here. I got to go back and check that and see what happened there. Something went haywire there. Yeah, I know that, but that's that we've clarified that issue. 24:6:20. Yeah, but it. Wait. 20. Let me see what 24:6 says. No. 24:6 has no relevance to anything. All right, I'm going to have to check that out and see what happened there. You going to send me an email? No, 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 no. We'll build a big tower to you, right next to the Eiffel Tower, and at the very top we'll say "Helped in the course." Okay, no, send me an email. Really, I got to check that out because I don't know what happened there. But let's do away with that. We can see it. We can still see there's evidence, but the Betula could be either one. Okay, let's continue. She never slept with a man. What in the world happened there? I'm going to have to go back and research that. Based on the above, okay. Like the word Betula and Nahara can either refer to a virgin or, in the case of Ruth 2:5-6, a non-virgin. Then said Boaz unto a servant that was set over the reapers, whose damsel, Nara, is this? And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, it is the Moabitish damsel, Nara, that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab. The damsel Boaz acquired about was Ruth, who at the time was a widow and therefore was not a virgin. So you can't say they would use either of these words. Just doesn't hold water. Okay, continuing on, just a little more. Based on the foregoing study of the two other words that may be translated virgin, we can conclude that both may mean either a virgin or a non-virgin. Thus, the rabbi's assertion that Isaiah would have chosen a word other than Ava if he attended that damsel in Isaiah 7:14 referred to a virgin. Try not to forget to send me that email, because this is a whole big deal to me. I don't understand. This is not good at all. We got to figure out what went wrong. I mean, I'll straighten it out, but I can't do it if I don't remember to do it. And since you're a young woman with a bright mind and I'm an old man with dementia, I need your email.
Don't tell Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's continue. In attempting to determine Isaiah's intended meaning of the word Alma, it will be helpful to see what the ancient rabbis who lived before the time of Yeshua believed Isaiah's intended meaning of the word Alma was in 7:14. These rabbis lived before the controversy over Yeshua's messiahship existed, so their opinion would not be affected by a religious or historical basis. See that? This is before Yeshua, so there's no bias here. The Septuagint, sometimes abbreviated LXX in Roman numerals, that's the number 70, is the name given to a Greek translation of the Tanakh. It had its origin in Alexandria, Egypt, and was translated by 70, that's why you get that LXX, scholarly Jewish rabbis in approximately 300 to 200 before the birth of the Messiah. These Jewish rabbis translated the Hebrew word Alma in 7:14 into the Greek word Parthenos, which can only mean virgin. So here we have a group of rabbis who have no problem with virgin. And that's because they lived because the Messiah came and they didn't have this agenda that the modern day rabbis have. Okay? Therefore, before the controversy over Yeshua Messiahship existed, these Jewish rabbis believed that Isaiah intended that Alma in Isaiah 14 referred to a virgin. 6. Because Alma always refers to an unmarried woman, if the Alma in Isaiah 7:14 was not a virgin, then God would be promising a sign involving fornication and immorality. It is unthinkable that God would sanction such a sin. Accordingly, the word Alma must refer to a virgin. 7. In Isaiah 7:14, the prophet said, therefore, and this one should be obvious, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. That's an attesting miracle. For a non-virgin to give birth would not necessarily be a miracle, but for a virgin to give birth would. Therefore, it is reasonable to conclude that Alma in 7:14 means virgin. 8. I like this one. Some Jewish rabbis claim that Isaiah could not have been predicting a virgin birth because of the impossibility for a virgin to give birth. I like this, though. Watch, this is neat. This view results not from a study of the text, but from a presupposition that such miracles cannot happen. Now, read this next. It is often effective to ask one of these rabbis if they believe the story of Isaac's birth. Most rabbis will answer affirmatively. The rabbi can then be challenged thusly. According to the Bible, Abraham was 100 years old and Sarah was 90 years old when Isaac was born. Is not that impossible? Rabbis will often respond to this challenge by saying, God did a miracle. The believer's response should then be, I agree. God performed a miracle in enabling Abraham and Sarah to have a child when they were well beyond the age of childbearing. In the same way, God performed the miracle when he caused Miriam, a virgin, to conceive and give birth to a child. Is anything too difficult for God? Conclusion. Matthew was correct in asserting that the virgin birth recorded in his gospel was the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy in 7:14. Virgin was Isaiah's intended meaning of the word Alma in Isaiah 7:14, and accurately reflects the intended meaning of God who inspired the scriptures. The English word virgin correctly translates the Hebrew word Alma in Isaiah 7:14. Like many other passages in the Bible, Isaiah 7:14, when compared with Matthew 1:19-23, affirms that there are no errors in the Brit Chadashah, which is in fact the inspired, authoritative word of God. Yeshua is, as the Brit Chadashah claims, the Messiah, and those who receive him as their Savior are forgiven for their sins. Now, here's the possibilities. Well, we're finished with what we have to do with the passage. I want to talk to you about something else for a minute.